Palestine group at Fordham University, like so many universities and colleges have. And I want to thank Dima Khalidi of Palestine Legal, Cooperating Counsel with the Center for Constitutional Rights. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is accepting applications for a paid year-long news production fellowship. Details at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced by Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Sam Alkoff. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
Where is your radio dial on Thursday afternoons from noon until 2? 90.7 FM is the place to be. Twice a month, DJ Charlie presents the World Beat Connection with the hottest Afro-Caribbean sounds in Portland radio land. Reggae, salsa, soca, New Orleans Afro-funk, Haitian compa and rara, and Antillean zouk share the airwaves with African highlife. Afrobeat, Congolese soukous, Malian blues, juju, and South African kwaito, among the other great styles. Traditional and modern expressions are all included. On alternate weeks, check out Top Rank in Reggae and Dancehall with Shocks of Sheba show, hosted by Teresa and Michelle. Any week, Thursdays at noon is sure to move ya.
KABU Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Personnel Committee will meet on the second Monday of each month at 6 p.m.
This is KBOO Portland.
Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott, today. Newark, New Jersey-based activist, attorney, and author Junius Williams on his brand new book, Unfinished Agenda, Urban Politics in the Era of Black Power. We take an inside look at the evolution of the civil rights and black power movements, their southern roots, and their application in northern cities like Newark, New Jersey. Also, the relationship between younger militants and the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, the war on poverty as it began, and income inequality today. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
I'm Max Pringle with these headlines. A brutal winter storm scattered snow, sleet, and freezing rain from North Florida up the southeast seaboard today. The latest weather adds to the misery of a bitter cold snap as bridges iced over and cars spun out on slickened overpasses. The National Weather Service said the snow and freezing rain was expected to spread up the coast from Florida to the Carolinas amid warnings that icy roads and low visibility could make driving treacherous. Accumulations of 3 to 5 inches were possible in eastern North Carolina. Georgia Governor Nathan Deal declared a state of emergency through Friday for 28 counties because of the frigid weather. The Weather Service said up to an inch of snow could fall as far south as Tallahassee, Florida, where it hasn't snowed in years. In other parts of the U.S., dangerously cold temperatures have been blamed for at least a dozen deaths, as well as freezing a water tower in Iowa and halting ferry service in New York. The National Weather Service issued wind chill advisories and freeze warnings Tuesday, covering a vast area from South Texas to Canada and from Montana through New England. Two Democrats are set to be sworn into the U.S. Senate. The additions narrow the Republican majority and complicate efforts by GOP Majority Leader Mitch McConnell to advance the White House's legislative agenda before the November midterm elections. Doug Jones of Alabama is one of two new members who will take the oath of office at noon today. He recently defeated controversial GOP candidate Roy Moore, who faced multiple allegations of child molestation, in a special election for Attorney General Jeff Sessions' vacated seat. The other is Minnesota Lieutenant Governor Tina Smith, who was appointed to replace Democrat Al Franken following his resignation over accusations of sexual misconduct. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un has reopened a key cross-border communication channel with South Korea, another sign of easing animosity between the rivals, even as Kim traded combative threats of nuclear war with President Trump. The North Korean leader said he has the nuclear button on his desk at the ready. Trump tweeted that he has a bigger button and his works. Former Director of National Intelligence James Clapper told CNN that Trump's trading threats with Kim only worsens already high tensions.
It's very disturbing. No one in the White House knows what is Kim Jong-un's ignition point, where one of these tweets is going to set him off and he's going to hit that button.
Outside critics accuse Kim of trying to use better ties with South Korea as a tactic to weaken the alliance between Washington and Seoul, as his country is grappling with toughened international sanctions over its nuclear and missile programs. President Trump is threatening to cut off U.S. aid money to the Palestinian Authority and is acknowledging that the Middle East peace process appears to be stalled. Trump says in a pair of tweets that, quote, "We pay the Palestinians hundreds of millions of dollars a year and get no appreciation or respect. They don't even want to negotiate a long overdue peace treaty with Israel," unquote. He adds that, quote, "The Palestinians no longer are willing to talk peace. Why should we make any of these massive future payments to them?" Trump infuriated many when he announced late last year that the U.S. would consider Jerusalem the capital of Israel and move its embassy there. Trump has long said he wants to broker Mideast peace, calling it the ultimate deal. Some political observers say a Trump administration proposal to include a citizenship question on the 2020 census questionnaire could lead to undercounts because some immigrant communities may be reluctant to fill out the form. And, as Christopher Martinez reports, lower counts could affect how federal funds are allocated in states like California with large immigrant populations.
The new citizenship question has been proposed by the Trump administration's Department of Justice. It says the question is needed in order to better enforce the Voting Rights Act. The census has not included questions about citizenship since 1950. Some critics call the new question a scary twist and a recipe for sabotaging the census by scaring off immigrants or people with an immigrant family member.
We already have a problem with underparticipation in immigrant communities that fear government or experience language barriers.
Jonathan Stein is voting rights program manager with the group Asian Americans Advancing Justice Asian Law Caucus.
If those communities have to report whether they are citizens or report what their immigration status is or report the immigration status of their family members that live in the household with them, they're much more likely to simply not fill out the form.
The decennial census count is required by the Constitution, providing a population count that is used to allocate congressional representatives. It's also used to allocate almost $700 billion in federal funding to states for programs like Medicaid. Reporting for Pacifica Radio News, KPFA, I'm Christopher Martinez.
I'm Max Pringle. You're listening to Sojourner Truth on Pacifica Radio.
That was our news headlines. I'd like to welcome to Sojourner Truth Junius W. Williams. He is an attorney, an educator, an advocate who is responsible for developing 2,000 housing units and many community centers in Newark, New Jersey. He is a graduate of both Amherst and Yale universities. He was elected the youngest president of the National Bar Association in 1978. He ran for mayor of Newark in 1982 and is currently director of the Abbott Leadership Institute at Rutgers University. He is listed among Ebony Magazine's 100 Most Influential Blacks in America. Junius Williams, welcome. The title, Unfinished Agenda. Why that title?
Because our quest for power in the United States of America is an unfinished agenda. Now, we can look at that in two levels. First, my own personal journey. I got hooked in the civil rights movement, and I wasn't going to let nobody turn me around.
And by our power, you mean the power of black people in the United States.
I'm talking about black people. Black people. And that's been, that concept has been expanded over time. I'm very much comfortable with the concept of progressive people, but we started as black people in this journey, and we have some distinctive interests. So that's the main purpose of it. And the other portion, of course, is my own personal journey. What have I learned? What am I going to be able to leave for my children and other people's children about how you get along in America and how you make change?
Alrighty. So tell us a bit about your background then. You hail from Richmond, Virginia.
Yes.
About your family.
I grew up in a middle-class family in Richmond. I was born in Suffolk, Virginia, the peanut capital of the world. My mother was the first black music teacher in Norfolk, Virginia, and my father was the first black high school instrumental teacher in Richmond, Virginia. Mm-hmm. So they met. He was singing, and somebody said, you need a good accompanist, so here's Bernice White. So that's how they met. So I came from a very musical family. They were both school teachers. I grew up in, as I said, middle-class Richmond, middle-class black Richmond, and, of course, all was segregated. I could go for days and never see somebody white. All my teachers were black. All my friends were black. I never had any white friends until I started leaving Richmond and going on some of the going into some of the programs in the north that my mother had staked out for me.
Was this before university then?
Before
you went to university?
Yes. Yes. I grew up in the late 50s and the early 60s. Mm-hmm. I left Richmond when I was 17, and that was in 1961 to go to Amherst College.
Mm-hmm. Right. And this was your first time then kind of going north when you went to university, or had you been before?
I had been before during the summers, because mm-hmm. that was part of Bernice Williams' plan. You got to get...
What was that plan?
The plan was middle-class Richmonders, if they could afford it and had that kind of vision, they said we got to get our children out of harm's way. We have to get them beyond the clutches of Jim Crow.
Mm-hmm.
So they wanted to send us north because that was supposed to be better.
Mm-hmm.
So my mother said, okay, you got to go to summer programs. I went to something called a High School Honors Science Institute at Michigan State. I went to summer camp in New Jersey. Other things like that to socialize me and let me know that this was something that I could do. So that when it came time to leave, she knew I was going to leave. I was ready to go.
Yeah, a world outside Jim Crow.
Yes.
Right. So at what point, I mean, you clearly are a political person, have been most of your life, still is. So at what point, what was your inspiration, and at what point did you seriously become political?
My first inspiration in terms of the movement, the civil rights movement, was when I saw the young people in Richmond, Virginia, coming from Virginia Union University, going in to sit in. I had looked at that from a distance, and I wanted to be a part of it. And my mother said, oh, no, they don't want high school kids because you all don't know how to be nonviolent and be disciplined. So I took her word for it. Later on, I met Charles Sherrod, who was the head of the Virginia Union University students, and I asked him, did you all say that? And he looked at me with a little smile and said, no, we never said that. Mm-hmm. So that was my mother trying to keep me out of harm's way.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Then there was another lady named Miss Tinsley. Miss Tinsley, I saw a picture of her in Ebony magazine being dragged across the street in Richmond. Mm. I still get a flush when I think about that. By two big, burly white cops. And that just infuriated me. And I wanted to be a part of that.
Mm-hmm.
But again, based on Bernice's plan, you go north to freedom. You don't stay here and get in harm's way.
Right. Well, it didn't quite pan out that way.
No, it didn't.
As it turned out. So you were inspired then in high school. I mean, growing up as a child, you were aware clearly of the injustices of Jim Crow around you.
Oh, sure.
And did you have any discussions in your family about it, or was it basically the plan to get you out and get you out of harm's way?
Well, see, my parents were really the wrong role models for me just to escape. I saw my mother take on Jim Crow in Suffolk, Virginia at a 5 and 10 cent store. When my brother and I, this was when I was in elementary school, we went in with her to buy something and we wanted to get some water. Well, the black water fountain was broken.
Mm.
Right next to it was the shiny brand new white water fountain, and it was working. So my mother said, go ahead and use the water. So, of course, The little sales lady comes right outside, all infuriated, and, "Don't you do this. You can't do this. Don't you?" My mother told her, "First of all, you talk to me." And it was all downhill for that lady after that. So we just as we're laughing now, my brother and I went out with our heads up, held high.
Our guest in studio is Junius Williams. He has a book, Unfinished Agenda, Urban Politics in the Era of Black Power. And this is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. So there were quite a few moments, and although your parents wanted to move you away from Jim Crow and away from segregation, they clearly were also inspirations of yours and the example of your mom as well as your dad.
Absolutely.
Okay. So then fast forwarding a bit then to your time at Amherst and a mixed, not segregated, a mixed environment. How what was it like? Did you live in the dormitories?
Yes.
Or
yes.
Right. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Well, for most of the time I did. At one point I went into the fraternity house, but then I came out, and that's part of my story. Well, it was mixed. I had some good friends. I had some people who had thought through their own upbringing, some white friends who thought through their own upbringing, and they were good people. I had some folks who hadn't thought through, and some of them who really didn't care. They were just outright racist. So part of my story was navigating that whole terrain.
Mm-hmm.
So I juxtaposed my position in Amherst at that time versus the folks that I knew were on the front lines in the South fighting Jim Crow. I was on the front line. They were on the front line. I was on the front line in the North. They were in the front line in the South. My front line was much more complicated because I had to learn how to read. I had to learn how to understand what folks were saying. And folks weren't walking around with sheets, but they had some of those same evil intents toward us as black folks.
Mm-hmm. So were you involved in doing activist work on the campus?
I got involved out of necessity. Somebody wrote a letter to the Amherst Student, which was a student newspaper, saying that civil rights was going too fast. Why go do all of this? black folks should just go slow. I mean, that's really what it said. And he didn't sign his name. So there was no discussion. But I could see that the campus was relating to this. He wrote two letters, and they let him put them in. So I wrote my letter. I wrote my first public declaration of where I was. And I said in so many words, if you're a man, why don't you just come on out and say who you are? Well, that silenced him.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of drew a line in the sand for me. We had a song in the movement called Which Side Are You On, Boy? Which Side Are You On? And that kind of made it necessary for me to step up, but it also made my friends declare, which side are you on this issue? You're going to be Junius's friend. You got to deal with what he's saying.
Mm-hmm.
So as a result of that, I became chairman of the civil rights group. We planned one of the biggest civil rights conferences that the district had, that the area had ever known. We had four colleges in the area: Smith, Holyoke, UMass, Amherst. We had over 1,000 kids came from all over the East Coast to that campus.
What do you think came out of that experience for you? Because a lot was going on in the South. It already began when you were in high school, right, with the sit-ins, et cetera. So here you were as young college students trying to do something in the North.
Yes, because it was a pivotal point in my thinking because already we were beginning to get to see another picture of what was going on in the North. Aside from my own experiences at Amherst, there was a whole ghetto experience out there where people were, you know, the Northern student movement, for example, was very much influential in what was going on in places like Harlem and Philadelphia. So there was another kind of movement going on which involved class as well as race. So I didn't have a clear class concept at that point, but I was beginning to get one. And this particular conference helped me focus on where I was going. The other thing it introduced me to indirectly was a man named Tom Hayden. Tom Hayden was one of our speakers. I didn't know Tom Hayden. Somebody on the committee said, let's get Tom Hayden, Students for a Democratic Society. I said, okay. So Tom Hayden came up and saw what I had done along with the other people. So in the spring, that was in the winter of 1965, in the spring of 1965, Tom Hayden came back to the Fort College area and sought me out. And I said, wow, you know, I'm very impressed, because by that time I knew who Tom Hayden was.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, I want you to come to Newark and work with us. And up to this point, nobody else had asked me to come anywhere to work for him. I hadn't heard from any colleges. I didn't. All I knew is I wanted to be in the movement. Because I had been to Montgomery. We can talk about that in a minute. I had been
to
Montgomery.
So this is after you had been south?
This is after I'd been south and gotten involved with SNCC.
Okay, well, hold that Tom Hayden story. We're going to come back to that.
Okay.
Because I do want to find out at what point and why you went south. And then I want to talk a little bit about your experiences there. Our guest is Junius Williams. He has a book, Unfinished Agenda, Urban Politics in the Era of Black Power. And we're talking very much about his life and his story, but there's such an interrelationship between the life that Junius led as a child up until now and the whole movement of the civil rights and the Black Power era. So, and this is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. So, Junius Williams, you're at Amherst. You have this huge conference, Ozzie Davis Saves the Day. We're going to talk a little bit later on about the interaction with Tom Hayden and you're ending up in Newark. But first, I want to find out about your going south, because your parents got you out of the South to the North, and then you decided to go back.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about that. At what point did that happen?
I just had to go. I had done all kinds of vigils, and I had done voter registration in Richmond and Springfield, Massachusetts. We had raised money.
This is after you were out of Amherst?
No. This is while I was in.
While you were in Amherst.
This is while I was in Amherst. I had allowed people from the civil rights movement to come and stay in my room if they wanted some downtime, some rest and relaxation, getting away from the Klan and all the problems that were down in the movement there. And I had done it all except be on the front line. Now, I had, as I told you earlier, I saw those kids being on the front line all the way up to Ms. Tinsley, who was, you know, probably in her 60s or 70s at that time. I had seen pictures. I had been to the March on Washington, really, truly by accident, because I was coming back from Africa. I worked for Crossroads Africa, thanks to Marion Wright Edelman. So I came back on that day, and my mother dropped my brother and I off at the March on Washington. And the people who amazed me most were the SNCC kids.
The Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee.
Yes, coming just in from Danville, Virginia, I believe, singing all those songs. And I had seen the SNCC Freedom Singers up at Smith College.
Mm-hmm.
Became friends with Cordell Reagan, who eventually married a friend of mine from Smith, Merble Harrington.
Mm-hmm.
And I just had to do it. In thinking about that, you know, it's been a while since I wrote the book, actually, because, you know, you write a book and then you put it there and you try to get it published.
Yeah.
So the publishing thing is a story in and of itself. So I've had about 3 or 4 years to think about it. And the most, I think that the common denominator that I always come back to is the songs, you know, the music.
The freedom, yeah, which was so important, so crucial.
In shaping people's minds and sustaining people. There was a song for everything, you know, or the song for every occasion. There was a song for everybody. You know, if you didn't have a vision of what freedom was, you know, somebody would say, I woke up this morning with my mind stayed on freedom. And you begin to think about that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you hear so much in that song. You hear Africa in the song, the call and response, the various other African elements that were in that music. And then you might get a little bit down, you say, but then you might say, ain't gonna let nobody, Lord, turn me round, turn me round. So that gave you another boost. You go out there and face the Klan. I remember one time, we haven't gotten to how I got there yet, but at one point, the first time I heard this song, I thought maybe I might die. And somebody starts singing, this may be the last time. It may be the last time. I don't know. So you just get ready. You get ready to face right. What's there. So it was a compelling nature of that music that just drew me right in. And so we got in the van one day, went down to my parents' house. They saw that rickety van that we were coming in. My father said, take my car, son. So we had he had a Buick station wagon. I'd be safer. Mm-hmm. And it was interesting because on the way down, because we had Virginia plates and not Massachusetts plates, we got away with something that probably most of folks would not have. Mm-hmm. Virginia plates, it was springtime, March of 1965. March, we were going to the Selma to Montgomery March.
Yeah.
And this white guy was with us, Fred Arano. And Fred was driving at that particular time, and we were all in the car. I think there were two or three of us were black and three whites.
Dangerous driving through the South.
Dangerous driving
through
the South. Interracial group at the time of this struggle.
Mm-hmm.
Two of us, two black guys. So the cops pulled us over. And so my companion and I don't remember his name now, but we got under the covers in the back of the station wagon along with the bags.
So you hid?
We hid and just left the four whites in the front. So Fred told him we were going to Florida to, you know, at the general bash outs
spring
that they
break?
Had. Spring break at Fort Lauderdale. And I could hear the cop. He said, well, y'all was swerving. He said, well, I guess I might have just blinked out a little bit off there. Okay, well, you be careful now. You hear? Go on.
And that's how you got over.
And that's how we got over. And we got down there, went to Montgomery first. You get to go to Montgomery before you go to Selma. And somebody said, check in with the SNCC office.
Yeah, I want you to talk a little bit about that, because mm-hmm. the welcome you got they didn't exactly roll out the red carpet.
Nope. Stokely Carmichael was upstairs on the second
Stokely
floor.
Stokely Carmichael, who was heading SNCC at the time.
It was 1965. He probably was in charge by then, yes. Or maybe he got elected in 66. I'm not so sure. But he was
a main figure.
A main figure in SNCC at that point. And they were in, as I say in the book, they were in the upper room on the corner of Jackson and High Street.
Mm-hmm.
So we go up there and six or seven of us. I think I'm trying to figure if it was six or seven. We were in the station wagon, so it was.
But y'all
seven.
Have arrived.
We have arrived
to work in the movement.
To work in the movement. Mm-hmm. What you gonna do with us? You on your way to Selma? What you going to Selma for? We need you here, with his Trinidadian accent. So mm-hmm. just like that, they told us to go
that
downstairs.
Was Stokely.
That was Stokely. Mm-hmm. Kwame Ture. Later he became, and he sent us downstairs. We said okay. We'll stay. They gave us a place to stay in somebody's house, and from that point on, it was on.
Yeah, and you had some pretty frightening experiences there with some racists. Tell us a bit about that, because it's hard for people today, thinking back of what people went through.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The idea was to demonstrate in Montgomery to back up or to even front up, as it came out to be, the whole march from Selma to Montgomery, which had been taken over by Dr. King.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, you got to understand that there's some rivalry amongst all people who work together. So there was a rivalry
in the civil rights groups, organizations at the time.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So that was that aspect. I didn't understand it until I got into it. Then the second thing was that SNCC didn't trust SCLC.
the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, which was Dr. King's organization.
Yes. Because SNCC didn't want King and SCLC to backslide on the whole question of voting rights and the proposed Voting Rights Act. They wanted it as strong as it could be. So they set up their own front in Montgomery, which was a brilliant thing to do. And it was amazing that they were able to do it. But I think back about the expertise it took to maintain that kind of front. Mm-hmm. And it's something that we can learn from. So what did I learn? I went downstairs and the police didn't want us to leave the corner. They didn't want us to even get the attention of going downtown. So they had it blocked off, and they had the regular police, but they had also empowered actually the Ku Klux Klan from the countryside to come in on horses who had these great big long cattle sticks. And every time we tried to march out, they would beat us.
Mm.
And the front of that group was the guys on horses because they enjoyed it. They enjoyed it. So they whacked heads as often as they could. I was quick enough to get out of the way.
Mm-hmm.
That at one point, as I said earlier, they backed several of us against a church. It was a black church that doors never opened for us. And we were up against the church, and we just had to start singing that song. And miraculously, there must have been about six or seven.
Do you remember the song?
Oh, yeah. This may be the last time. Maybe the last time. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
We were just there waiting for the onslaught to come. And they stopped. They heard that song. That's when I really believed in God.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I was a member of the church. I'd been baptized in Richmond, Virginia, Ebenezer Baptist Church. But something bigger was protecting us at that point. They didn't come up and get us.
Mm-hmm.
They peeled off and went back. So
okay.
we, what else did I learn? They wouldn't let us out the front door, so to speak, Jackson and I. So we went around the back and went through Jackson State. I'm sorry.
Right.
Jackson
so the route that they were expecting you to take on the march, you mm-hmm. didn't take.
Right.
And instead you went around the back way,
we
a different
way.
So they were totally unprepared
they
for that.
Unprepared for that.
Meaning the police.
The police yeah. and the horsemen. And we went through Alabama A&M, I believe it was. I'm glad I wrote the book when I did because I don't remember all these details.
Yeah.
But we went through the local black college, through the back door there, singing those songs. Which side are you on, boy? Which side are you
and
on?
And you could sing still.
I love to sing.
Okay.
And so that saved my life. We if we have time, we'll talk about that.
Yeah.
Singing and music saved my life. So we went through Alabama State. And up the steps, and we brought all the students out. How do we bring the students out? They just bolted from their classrooms.
They just ran out.
They just ran out. Some of those poor teachers were trying to get up. They got rolled over. Other teachers just stepped aside and said, yes, sir, you go
okay.
do what you got to do.
Uh-huh.
So now the army had doubled. We were maybe 250 before, and a lot of the people in that particular bunch were white, coming from up north like I did. But now we had homegrown black folks, and the force doubled. It was hard to keep us contained.
Yeah.
Dr. King came over. I don't know if you want me to tell you about how much time we have, but I can tell you. Yeah, you want me to talk about that story as well?
I do.
At one point, It was getting too big to contain, and so the SCLC people heard about what was going on, and they sent Martin Luther King over mm-hmm. to kind of put this fire out.
Quiet it down a bit.
Quiet it down, because all the attention was supposed to be on the Selma March, which was slowly coming toward Montgomery as we were in mm-hmm. Montgomery itself. And all the cameras were out there. We had very little press
yeah.
at first. So he came over. And everybody said, oh, Lord, we're going to march downtown now. And
Dr. King is here.
Dr. King is here. Lord mm-hmm. have mercy. Of course, the SNCC folks were very skeptical.
Mm-hmm.
The SNCC hierarchy.
They were not impressed.
They were not impressed.
Mm-hmm.
And so we marched, and miraculously, the police let the barricades aside. And so
when Dr. King was
Dr. King was there. So we marched, and here was Dr. King in front, and I was just happy to be there. I didn't care about who was going to get us there. We were going downtown.
Did you get an impression of him? I mean, did you get to see him close up?
I did, because he, at some point, maybe two blocks from where we started, he turned around and brought us right back behind the barricades. So in that little turnaround, I was as close as maybe 6 feet away from him.
Mm-hmm.
And there was an aura about the man. Man, the man was special. There's no doubt about that.
Mm-hmm.
We weren't particularly, those of us who wanted to march downtown, we weren't happy at that time. But there was an aura about Dr. King.
Because he brought y'all back around behind the barricades.
He brought us back over there. And in the meantime, the cops was there and they knew the deal. And they were throwing peanuts at us, just smiling and grinning. Y'all ain't going nowhere. Look what you did. Look what your leader did to you. That's what they were really saying.
Yeah.
But I had my doubts about Dr. King for a while there, and I didn't keep up with him the way I should have, because later on, as it was time for his life to come to a head and to a close, he made some fantastic changes in terms of his philosophy about economics and politics.
He became a lot more radical.
He became a lot more radical. In his last year. I didn't even know about it until after he died. So I was very sorry.
And he was a young man.
He
died as a young man. So.
He died as a young man. So I was very sorry.
I let
that one incident kind of color my relationship with Dr. King. But I am definitely a fan of his now. So we went back, and at some point we had enough people behind those barricades, so they had to let us out. And we went downtown, and that was a... can I read a little bit about that?
You can, and the voice you're hearing, our guest, is Junius Williams. His book, Unfinished Agenda, Urban Politics in the Era of Black Power, fascinating history, a personal story intertwined, really, with the history of the civil rights and black movement. And we're going to get a special treat because, Junius Williams, you're about to share a piece with us from your book.
This is after we got past the barricades. But the police and their henchmen must have smartened up about the rough stuff or heard about the mood at the rally the night before. After 4 or 5 days of trying to march, news of Montgomery was beginning to leak out into the media. There were more cameras each day. And I'm going to skip ahead a little bit here. All along the route of the march, this is after they let us out from behind the barricades. All along the route of the march, black folks stood on the sidewalks, some of them watching, some cheering us on like we were a conquering army. It was like the pictures of the American troops marching into Paris after the defeat of the Nazis in World War II.
Mm.
Tears coming to my eyes as I watched the old people along the route, some of them too old to even stand up, but they were our best cheerleaders with their gentle ways. How many times had they been forced to say, "Yassa, boss man"? How many sidewalks had they been forced to vacate to let a white man and his family go by? How many lynchings had they seen, or maybe even escaped, to live in the shadow of Governor George Wallace's state house, still on their knees, until this day, when they could watch us march proudly by? My heart went out to them. I was marching and singing and chanting and clapping as loud as I could, for them as well as for me.
We are going to take a short station break, and when we return, we are going to continue our discussion with Junius Williams, his book, Unfinished Agenda, Urban Politics in the Era of Black Power. We'll be right back.
Hi, this is Gloria Steinem.
This is Joni Mitchell.
This is Brother Cornell West, and you are listening to Sojourner Truth with host, my dear sister, Margaret Prescott.
And Silas found the jail, had no money, let it go for bail.
The music is from Soundtrack for a Revolution. The song is Eyes on the Prize. The artist is Joss Stone. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. Check out the show on our website at sotrueradio.org and like and friend us on Facebook. You'll find the show there and lots more. We now continue our conversation with activist attorney and author Junius Williams. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. And Junius, we've talked about your going south, about your experiences in the South and working with SNCC while you were there. Now, we know that a lot of folks, there was a lot of violence, a lot of folks got beat, a lot of folks also got arrested, went to jail. Tell us about your experience. Were you arrested in the South?
Yes. James Foreman asked who would be willing to go to jail. And I said, okay, I'll go.
And James Foreman, one of the leaders
of SNCC. He was the executive director of SNCC.
Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, people who are just joining us.
So we marched down to the state capitol. We were trying to picket the front of the state capitol, which had an American flag and a Confederate battle flag. And the city cop said, you can't march on the sidewalk. So we walked out into the street. The state cop said, you can't march in the street. So we saw where that was going. So we just sat down. And they had the paddy wagon. They came up. Several hundred of us were arrested. They put us in jail. But see, this was part of the genius of SNCC. They had people ready to go to jail each day. Hundreds of people had to go each day to fill the city jail. And that's what happened. Because then the second day I was in jail, they said, well, we got to move you to state prison. So they moved me and some others to Kilby State Prison. To this day, I don't know where it is. I know it's somewhere cold.
So was it because too many people were coming into the jail?
Yes.
So they had to...
They had to siphon some off.
Okay.
And this happened. This went on for 3 days. 3 days, hundreds of people each day for 3 days. Remember that, young people. You just can't go out there and do one little thing with 50 people and expect that's going to be what you're going to do to make changes. No, hundreds of people each day.
Or make a post on Facebook.
Or make a post on Facebook.
One post and Lord figure you've done it.
Yes, yes, yes. And get a whole lot of amens and then nobody show up. So we went to Kilby State Prison. So while we were there.
What happened?
This happened.
Reading from your book.
Yes. Because there were so many of us, the powers that be decided to move some of us to Kilby State Prison. After one night of singing and clapping and raising as much hell as possible, I was among those transported to Kilby. Fast forwarding in a little bit. There were 152 to 200 of us transferred to Kilby. They separated us by sex and put each group into two big holding cells. The women were across the hall from the men. The psychological war began almost immediately. There were no beds, just mattresses on the floor with no sheets or blankets. The later became the colder it got. At some point in the early evening, some guards appeared and threw in some blankets. I had found a mattress away from the door and turned over to see a mad scramble for the few blankets they threw on the floor with dust flying all over the place. No way was I going to enter that fray, and so I resigned myself to being cold for the night. Then, Worth Long took charge. Worth is a short man with glasses. He looked like a stereotypical political organizer from the books of Kafka and Dostoevsky. I found out later that he had been in SNCC for some time and had been one of the field secretaries working in Selma and the communities in Lowndes County, Alabama. SNCC had a deeper involvement in Selma than did SCLC, despite the headlines for King in the March. Worth got up on one of the tables in the holding pen and got everybody's attention by yelling louder than the combatants for blankets on the floor. Once most of us were listening, he began. I don't know about you, but if I was a man, I wouldn't take a blanket for myself unless there was a blanket for everybody. He paused and let that sink in. Then he said it again, establishing eye contact with everybody in the cell. As we who were without blankets waited, one by one, those who had scrambled for the prize came up and threw their blanket into a pile. The pile grew. And the guards who had been standing outside the locked gate to watch the niggers fighting one another for blankets had to take a second look at the new black men that emerged from the struggle. One of the things that they do is make us fight among ourselves.
That's it.
Worth explaining. If they can't get blankets for all of us, then we will all just sleep cold. In less than 5 minutes, he turned a pack of individuals who were following their individual instincts for survival into a group of men who were willing to stick together.
What a story.
I tell you, that mantra, that has been my mantra ever since I heard that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, ever since I witnessed that, I should say. Because you just can't do for yourself. If I can't have a blanket, then you shouldn't have a blanket. You know, I can't be free unless you're free, and vice versa. So if we all understand that, we can do a whole lot.
Absolutely. We are now going to fast forward to back to the story earlier in our discussion. You talked about meeting the young organizer with Students for a Democratic Society, Tom Hayden, who then invited you. You had been south, and you're now back in the north, so you have all of that experience, including of the blanket in the state prison. And so you've run into Tom Hayden, and he's invited you to go to Newark, a whole different scene in Newark from Montgomery.
Yeah, I mean, it was like I had suddenly gotten some credibility and some experience, and Tom said, "We want you to come to Newark." And I said, "Where's Newark?" And so he explained, and he said that the civil rights movement...
Newark in New Jersey.
Newark, New Jersey. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, I'm glad you're bringing me back, because it's the radio.
Right.
I said, well, I'm planning on going to Alabama. I'm going to go with Stokely. I understand he's going into Lowndes County. And So Tom said, the civil rights movement is over. I said, what do you mean? The civil rights movement? He said, yeah, this stage of the movement is over. What we need is people who are going to come up north and fight the larger problems that have to do with class and race. He said, we've got the 1964 Civil Rights Act. We're going to get the 1965 Voting Rights Act. What else is there to do? He said, there are some of us that are working in Newark on problems that have to do with class and race, and Newark is a majority black city, and you ought to come on board. So I thought about it for a while. Into the mix came my parents' contention that I ought not to be in the movement anyway full time. I ought to keep on going to school. And I said, the only place I could possibly go is to law school. And they said, all right, go to law school, do something with yourself. So I played a very dangerous game with them. I applied to two law schools. One of them was Columbia, one of them was Yale. So I got into both of them. And I decided with that announcement by Tom, or that pronouncement by Tom, that I could start in Newark, and if I didn't like it, I could go to law school and everybody would be happy. So that's how I got to Newark, and that's how I got into Yale Law School.
The other thing is that you also became one of the youngest directors, I think, in the Model Cities program, right? Model Cities and a whole set of other programs came out. I'll have to say that at some point I was hired in the Model Cities program in Brooklyn. I want you to talk a little bit also about what it was like then working. I mean, from Model Cities, you also at some point you ran for mayor in Newark. You had a taste of what can happen with the black political class. And I was interested in your analysis around that, because part of what happened on the heels of the civil rights movement, and then you had all these black mayors that were elected in different cities. And we also have a situation now today where you have poor black people today, the most impoverished black people today, are actually poorer than they were 30 years ago. So I want you to talk a little bit about what do you think happened. I mean, here we had this tremendous movement, height of the movement, lives were lost, people went to prison, people dedicating their whole lives to organizing. And what you call the empire was then able to step in and kind of shift some things in the direction that they wanted it shifted in.
One of the most important things that we did in Newark, and I was very glad to be a part of this and one of the architects, was to shift from purely confrontational politics into becoming very good at electoral politics. Mm-hmm. That's one of the untold stories in many of our communities, that shift. Because you just can't do that overnight without some kind of thought and some kind of planning, and we were able to do that. That's part of the story.
A kind of an inside-outside strategy.
At this point, it was mainly beating our swords into plowshares or something like that. We were very good at taking on the man frontally.
Mm-hmm.
We knew how to do that. But to get Ken Gibson elected, the first black mayor of Newark, it took a whole different level of skills that we didn't have. So we joined together with some of the original black political class who had helped put in the traditional white mayor, who was Adonijo at that time. They had the skills to get out the vote, propagandizing. We had the energy coming from the street. We joined together and came up with this organization called the United Brothers, which was headed by Mary Baraka.
Mm-hmm.
And we were able to do
that. Who used to be Leroy Jones.
Who used to be Leroy mm-hmm. Jones. So we were able to make that transition, and we won. In 1970, we elected Ken Gibson, the first black mayor of Newark, and he was the first black mayor of a major city in the Northeast. There were only a few other black mayors of big cities at that time. So at that point, many people thought we had arrived. This was an end product.
Mm-hmm.
This was the end of the journey. We're here. We're going to get absorbed in the political system, just like the Italians got absorbed in, just like the Irish before them. But it doesn't work that way. It didn't work that way. It didn't work that way because the power that was in the city was taken from the city and into the suburbs. When the white entrepreneurs and the entrepreneurial and management class moved out of the city and into the suburbs, taking the jobs and the money with them.
Mm-hmm.
So here we were. We had black power, quote unquote, but what were we in charge of? Some people understood what that meant. Those of us who were organizers and out in the street, it meant we just had to go after the next level of power. We have to reshape and go forward just as we were doing before. The strategies and tactics might be different, but we had to confront power at the state level to get our just due of the tax money. We had to confront the federal government, which by that time was backing off because they had said black folks got as much as they're going to get. We gave you that Voter Rights Act. We gave you that right sitting in front of the bus. I don't know why you think we're going to make you have the fair share of your
economic power
in the whole in these cities. You're not going to get it. It was another fight mm-hmm. coming, but the black political class didn't want to take on that fight, including the mayor at that time, Ken Gibson.
They took their blanket and ran. Getting back to that whole blanket story,
they took their blanket and ran, and they did not concern themselves with the fate of the rest of the people who didn't have a blanket.
Mm-hmm.
And whose possibilities of getting a blanket were decreasing instead of increasing. Jimmy Carter, Democratic president, he was noted for two things. He increased the military more than had ever been increased before, and he was beginning to dismantle the social programs, which was
the safety net
for the cities. Now, how are you going to get that back? You have to combine the power in the street with the powers in the suite. If there's any mantra that comes from my book, that's the one thing you have to learn. Power is not going to just roll over. You got to keep going. But instead, the black political class settled for titular positions in the Democratic Party. And so not only in Newark, but all around the country, we began to slip.
That divide then between the black political class and people who kind of moved up, leaving others behind, began and widened to where it is now today.
And, well, there's one way to prove that. And when Ken was elected, I think about 70% of the people came out to vote. Each year thereafter, and we've had three black mayors now for the last 40 plus years, the number of people who came out to participate in the voting at the voting booth has gone down to the point where the last time Cory Booker got elected, there were about 30% people who participated in the electoral process. That's how folks vote.
And Cory Booker, presidential aspirations, he's now a senator, and develops a kind of a national persona as a kind of a populist guy down with the people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, that's not true. Cory Booker was manufactured. Maybe that's too hard a word, but I'm going to stick with it.
No, be hard.
He was created by forces outside of Newark because there was a power vacuum in Newark for the very reason that I'm telling you. Cory Booker came to Newark with a whole lot of money from people whose interest it was to see that the wherewithal and all of the value in the city of Newark could be sucked out. And you see that made manifest today in the struggle we have against this so-called school reform, which is really privatization
of public education.
Of public education. Mm. And Cory Booker had a great deal to do with that. Getting back to the poor people, one of the things we lost was knowledge of this history that you and I are talking about. So if you don't know the history, then you don't know the skills. All you hear is that Martin Luther King was a wonderful person. He had a dream. You don't know that Martin Luther King came out for a guaranteed minimum income. You don't know that unless you study it. People lost the skill levels to take on the power structure. And that's where we are now.
Unfinished Agenda, Urban Politics in the Era of Black Power. The author is Junius Williams. He's lived it. He's been through it. And we only got to the tip of the iceberg in this discussion that we are having today. So, folks, you're just going to have to find this book and pick it up. I feel this interview is unfinished. Yes, now I really understand the title of your book. I started asking you about that. See that?
It is.
That's how it is. Thank you so very much for joining us.
I've really enjoyed it. Thank you for what you do.
We're out of time. I'd like to thank our guest, Junius Williams. Today's show produced by Margaret Prescott. I'd like to thank the entire Sojourner Truth team, Sherelle Withers, our engineer, Mr. T. Teddy Robinson, and to all who helped to make this show possible. If you'd like a copy of today's show, please contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or go online to pacificaradioarchives.org.
Good morning. It is 8:58, and this is KBOO Portland. Coming up in just about 2 minutes, Teresa Mitchell brings you the news you're not supposed to know. Press Watch. At 9:30 on Fight the Empire, Per Fogering welcomes investigative reporter Lucy Commissar. And at 10, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. Coming up at 11 this morning on Between the Covers, author Rex Burkholder presents his Activist Toolkit with lessons on how to become a successful leader in your community. And at 11:30, Black Book Talk hears from Stephen Hanks, author of The Achy Tree, a descendant's quest for his slave ancestors on the Eskridge Plantations. KBOO keeps you informed, and you can get involved. Go to kboo.fm and click on Donate to become a member.
Hello, KBOO listeners. Turn in Friday nights from 6 to 7 p.m. for Bread and Roses. This collective has been on air since 1978, making it the longest-running feminist news and public affairs radio show in the country. You can find Bread and Roses on KBOO's website, kboo.fm/breadandroses, or on Facebook at KBOO Bread and Roses Radio. We hope you tune in.
This is Press Watch, a weekly counter-propaganda and left opinion program here on your people-supported free radio station, KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. Join me for a brief peek behind the video veil of monopoly, media manipulation, and an examination of the news you're not supposed to know. Well, good morning and happy 50th anniversary, KBOO. I'm in a great mood this morning because peace is breaking out in Seoul and Pyongyang, and Washington is having fits over it. It's wonderful, wonderful news to wake up to. North and South Korea both seem keen for the North to take part in the 2018 Winter Olympic Games in the South. That's according to BBC's text, and I'm going to read a bit from theirs, and I want you to understand that I'm just going to throw in comments where I feel like it, and I'm going back and forth with, I'll be going back and forth. With this print, you can get, of course, from bbc.co.uk, which will then redirect to bbc.com, which does change the content. And I used to know a Swedish website in which I could do my news you're not supposed to know thing and use that for redirection. And so it would seem that I was pulling up BBC or whatever from Sweden, and then I wouldn't get these little diversions, which I don't like. So I'll find another way. Because that website seems to be gone. But the BBC writes, there are still hurdles to overcome before North Korea